you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us again today. Got a lot to talk about, including in our second hour, what happens with couples in the bedroom. Snoring, sleep restlessness, different schedules, you name it, trying to work in bed. All the things that can be sources of sleep conflict for couples. We're going to talk with RAND's Wendy Troxell. She has a brand new book out called Sharing the Covers, Every Couple's Guide to Better Sleep. And I know there'll be a number of listeners want to call in with advice from Wendy. She both researches couples' sleep patterns and is a clinician as well, using cognitive behavioral therapy to help people improve their sleeping with their partner. But we begin with another extremely important health issue, and that is the current status of COVID-19 and vaccination efforts. We welcome back weekly guest with us from our neighbor in Pasadena, Huntington Hospital, infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, very good morning to you.
And good morning to you too, Larry.
Let's start with where we stand on coronavirus here in Los Angeles County and throughout our listening area of Southern California. Things are looking very good.
Indeed they are. And I think that we are now entering the period where we're going to be testing the strength and sort of the wall, if you will, of our vaccines. California has been very aggressive in getting people vaccinated, and it does appear that the vaccines are beginning to hold back another surge of COVID, at least at this time. But the true test is going to be Memorial Day and July 4th. If we can maintain this level, very low level of infection, then we are in very good shape.
That's good to hear. I wonder, though, about there still is this minority that is vaccine resistant. In some cases, perhaps people who can't leave their home to get a vaccine. Obviously, if they're not going out, they're at less risk, as long as everyone in the household who is going out in the world is vaccinated. But what are your thoughts about those two issues? First of all, how to, or if it's possible, to provide enough peace of mind for people who are resistant to get the vaccine and to make the vaccine mobile enough to get it to harder to reach places?
Well, for the first is that it's very clear that the vaccine is highly effective, and we're now about 8 months out of the Pfizer and Moderna data that shows that the immunity induced by these vaccines holds. And so that's very, very important. It appears to be very, very safe, especially the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna. Really very few side effects except a little bit of flu-like illness after the second vaccine. And it is important, of course, to get that second vaccine. I want to reiterate that. In terms of folks that are still vaccine hesitant, so we have good time now. We've got about 8 months of study with these vaccines, and over 70 million people have been vaccinated with these vaccines. So that really is showing robust data and efficacy. And the second thing is we have to make the vaccines easy to get. And as you pointed out, folks that are at home or may not be able to get out, there are programs now that both LA County, Pasadena has been doing it as well, to reach out to those people and get them vaccinated with mobile units. We want to encourage people for the science, but also just for the ease of access to get vaccinated, and it's becoming much easier to do so. You may even want to entice a few people. There's been proposals about paying young people $100 or giving them $100 bond for their education to get vaccinated. Whatever it takes to get as many people vaccinated as possible will help the entire community.
Yeah, I think it's West Virginia, if I'm not mistaken, that's doing, just as you said, $100 savings bond as an inducement. I'll be interested to see how effective that is, because obviously, you know, a fair amount of money. But if it really is feared that somehow down the road the vaccine is going to make them sick, or affect them in other ways that some people are fearful of, I wonder if that will get them over the hump.
It might. And again, we have a good track record now for many months with many millions of people vaccinated to show how safe and effective. I think what's happening in California, speaks to the power of the vaccines right now. Now, are they perfect? No. Do we maybe need to do some adjustments as more variants become apparent? Maybe. But they are very, very safe. And this is an enormous accomplishment in science right now to create this very effective, highly effective vaccine that remains effective over a pretty prolonged period of time. The flu vaccine is not as good as this vaccine in terms of its efficacy and its length of durability. So it really is an important achievement, and I would strongly, strongly encourage everybody to get the vaccine. COVID, we know what COVID can do. It's very, very dangerous and can kill people very quickly. This vaccine will protect you from that.
Just looking and seeing the LAPD reporting today that its vaccination effort for its staff has slowed dramatically. Only 6 employees received a first dose over the course of the past week. About 50% of departmental employees have received a first dose. 40% of employees are fully vaccinated. Now, that includes sworn and non-sworn personnel as well. And I don't know whether you're willing to weigh in on this, but once the vaccines are given full authorization by the FDA, do you think that it's ethically okay to compel people in certain professions to be vaccinated?
Well, that's a very difficult issue. I think the more important thing is to really ask why are they hesitant? And some of it has to do with fear about the vaccine. Some of it is due to misinformation that's put out on social media. Some of it may be cultural. Some of it may be religious. And so you really have to address those issues in a fair and equitable way, and then try to convince the person that, you know, this is a very safe thing for you and for your family. And we know for sure that patients really do listen to their doctors. So it is important for all providers to say to their patients that getting vaccinated for COVID-19 is a very, very important part of their health. And I think when it comes from healthcare professionals in the office, that they have a relationship with this person, that carries a lot of weight rather than politicians or other people encouraging that. Although it's certainly anybody who can encourage it, pastors, neighbors, friends, family. I think once people see that, you know, lots and lots of people are doing this, it'll carry along a few people that maybe wouldn't have gotten it in the first place.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, noted infectious disease specialist. She's been joining us weekly for more than a year on these segments in which we update you on the latest on COVID-19 and vaccination. 866-893-KPECC. Susan in Altadena wants to know when we're likely to see booster shots, and is it likely that we'll need to use a booster from the same manufacturer as the one that we received our initial vaccinations from?
Yes, well, those are really good questions, Susan, and the answer is we don't quite know yet. There's no question that we're very concerned about the presence and the emergence of variants. We have some fairly nasty variants circulating right now. However, they are captured for the most part by the current vaccine, so that's good news. But with the situation in India and other parts of the world where the virus is really just raging, creates an opportunity for the virus to become even more mutated and eventually escape the vaccine. So the vaccine manufacturers, Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, J&J, are all looking at that and preparing to create a booster that would probably include most of those variants. Those would be what we call polyvalent vaccines, so they have more than one bit of information to try to cover the variants that emerge. We do this with influenza, so we have the capabilities of doing it, and there's certainly data to suggest that it works. How we do it and when we do it is going to be a little bit more problematic. It may be likely that we encourage people to get vaccinated with the same vaccine. There might be some data that would suggest using a different vaccine would be helpful. We don't know yet, but that is being evaluated.
Has there been any study of people who got two different types of vaccine? I know that's a very small minority of those vaccinated, but if I recall correctly, there were some people for reasons of supply and availability who got two shots of the MRA, but one Pfizer and one Moderna. Are those folks being studied?
I don't know if they're being studied specifically and followed, but that certainly has happened. And I know that the British have looked at that as a possible option when, as you described, there's been a shortage of one or the other. These vaccines are very, very similar. It's only in the sort of non-genetic part of the vaccine that they differ, and that allows them to have a different patent. But it does appear to be safe. Anecdotally, we have had some patients that have had that happen to in our vaccine clinic. and they did fine. So there doesn't appear to be any deleterious effect. Whether it actually enhances your immune response, we don't know, and that is something that's worth looking into. And that data is being captured by the statewide systems that monitor the second vaccine sequence.
And not that it shows anything substantive about effectiveness, but I'd also be curious if in the second vaccine they still got, you know, the typical sort of reaction of sore arm or flu-like symptoms after the second shot, the same as people who got the same vaccine for both of theirs. It would be interesting to know those kinds of things.
It would be. My suspicion is, and I know for the one patient that happened to in our clinic, they did get a second reaction. So the reaction is to the spike protein. That's saying your immune system knows what it's dealing with. It's not so much to the rather inert little oily molecule that's used to transport that information into the body. So yes, you would probably still have an immune response even if it was a different second vaccine.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital, with us on Air Talk. A couple of pieces of news from Pfizer, one of which is that the FDA is expected to soon offer emergency use authorization for younger teens, 12 to 15, to use the Pfizer vaccine, which would, of course, be a big help for high schools and middle schools. Also, Pfizer is looking at getting its permanent approval sometime this year, not just emergency use authorization. Dr. Reiner, first of all, on Pfizer being used for younger teens down to 12, your thoughts about that, and you think that's coming likely soon?
I think that's coming likely soon, and I think that it's very encouraging, and I know a lot of parents who are anxious to get their young teens vaccinated. Although sometimes they don't get as sick as adults, they certainly can be spreaders of disease, and to be able to try to continue to maintain this wall of protection against ongoing surges, we have to have all populations that can carry the virus vaccinated. So I'm really encouraged by that as well.
And the permanent approval, does that really change much?
It might help a few people that don't like the word emergency use authorization, that by be permanently approved, that gives them some more comfort in going ahead and getting vaccinated. So there might be some advantage there. It doesn't change much in terms of the implementation of the vaccine, but I think it does speak to the fact that we know now that they're very safe and appear to be very effective.
People who have been fully vaccinated yet still get COVID with these cases that are, you know, much less serious and not leading people to be hospitalized. Is there something to be learned there from those who have these breakout cases?
Well, we know it happens because it certainly happened at the beginning of the trials with Moderna and Pfizer. There were documented cases of COVID in people who were vaccinated, and they did appear to be much less symptomatic. There have now been a few deaths that have been attributed, hospitalizations and deaths that have been attributed to people that were vaccinated and either didn't respond to the vaccine or were exposed to a very high amount of virus. We know that happens with all vaccines. Vaccines are not perfect. And we know it happens with influenza with great regularity, where people are vaccinated and then they may still get the flu, although usually it's a much less nasty course of it. But for the most part, these are incredibly effective vaccines, much more than some of the vaccines we've used before, certainly with like the flu shot, for example. And so it will protect you the vast majority of the time. These cases are very, very rare. You're much more likely to be hit by a car or struck by lightning than to get really sick and hospitalized and die of COVID if you've been vaccinated. So it's a very rare event. It is something we should watch and find out who those non-responders are and look at them very carefully, but it's very uncommon. And so it is kind of hard to study in terms of it doesn't have much applicability to the general public.
Is it possible that those individuals who were hospitalized and later died of COVID-19 could have contracted it before they were fully vaccinated?
Absolutely, and that does happen. I've had it happen to one of my patients, actually. And what was very interesting is that I think he might have been sicker, but he got the vaccine the day after he found out he was positive for COVID. And so, the day before he was discovered to have COVID. So who knows? The vaccine may have some treatment efficacy as well in the setting of acute COVID. We don't know that. It's not indicated for that. But we do know that we use vaccines, the Ebola vaccine, for example, for treatment during acute disease. So if it sort of boosts your immune system to respond to acute disease, that's an interesting thing. But it is possible that happens. It has happened very frequently. And it is also possible that perhaps they took a medication that may have decreased the efficacy of the vaccine. That's rare, and I think that's unlikely. But we know that people don't respond for one reason or another, and sometimes that can lead to infection down the road.
Michael in Orange County writes on the page, hearing continuing stories of health professionals who refuse to get vaccinated, who may seem prone to misinformation and rumors, should really raise red flags about the reasoning of some in the healthcare system. I wonder if you can speak to that, Dr. Schreiner, because I wonder, are these healthcare professionals who perhaps don't understand the science involved in the vaccine? So, you know, they're responsible for important parts of care, but don't necessarily, in some of these cases, have the full scientific understanding of what's at work.
Well, it's a complicated issue, and I think that this all comes down to personal choice and being as informed as you can be. You would expect healthcare professionals to be very informed about this disease, and those of us who see the disease, that is the biggest teacher of all, that this is a really terrible, terrible infection, and it can kill you very quickly. And, I would say that alone is a very important lesson to, you know, go ahead and get vaccinated. But there are personal choices that are complicated, and I think that it is important to be respectful of that, to try to answer the questions that they may have or the concerns. You know, everybody is prone to the social media factor, and that may be driving some of this. It got kind of tangled up in politics for a while, and that's been a problem. So it's a very complicated issue, even for healthcare workers. They're human as well, and I think that although they have personal experience with this disease and can see the devastation, they may make choices that not all of us would agree with.
We'll continue with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, where she's infectious disease specialist, and she is such an important part of our KPCC family, where for more than a year, on essentially a weekly basis, she's been spending a great deal of her time answering listener questions, talking with us about the latest on COVID-19, and that's, of course, transitioned into much more about vaccines over the recent months. You have questions for her. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tweet at AirTalk, post on the Facebook page. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, streaming at kpecc.org, or always with you on your smartphone on the KPECC app. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Pasadena's Huntington Hospital, is with us. Norma in Lakewood says she just got a message from the state that she never got her second shot. She said, but I did a week ago. Should I reach out to correct this? Dr. Schreiner, should she follow up on that?
Yes, she should, because perhaps there's somebody out there who didn't get their second shot, and they need to be aware of that. It is important to get the second shot. That really locks in the immunity, and so she should call the state and just inform them that she did indeed get it, perhaps if she has proof of that with a record on her certification card. That would be helpful as well. But it is very, very important to get the second shot. That really does lock in the immunity with the vaccine.
Today, I think we're expected to enter the yellow tier because we will have gone a week at these lower levels of COVID-19. So what, if anything, does that change?
Well, it does test the vaccine. Every time we open up a little bit more, it's just sort of dipping your toe in the pool of COVID there. So we have to see how things go. This is going to be the test over the next few months to see how robust our protection is. You know, California, we had a huge amount of disease in the wintertime, and so there's a lot of natural immunity that will begin to wane because we know that natural immunity doesn't last as long as that induced by the vaccines. So as we move forward, we're going to have to watch this very carefully. And there are going to be challenges. It's very common for these viruses to be seasonal, and we may see some uptick in the fall and the winter again with COVID. I think that we're going to be living with it for many years, but hopefully on a much, much lower level where we can manage it more like just influenza.
Julie in the Valley with a really good question, wondering, does having a strong immune response to the second shot mean you're unlikely to be in that 5% of vaccinated people who gets COVID? I know that not having a reaction to the second shot doesn't mean anything, but is the reverse possibly true?
Well, we don't know that yet, Julie, and I think that is a very good question. The immune system is very complicated, and how people respond to vaccines can be very individual dependent. And so some folks may not have any kind of reaction whatsoever, and if you look at their immunity to COVID, it's very strong. Other people might have a very high amount of inflammation after the second shot and feel kind of punk for the day or two, but that does not necessarily mean that you're more protected. And so our understanding of the immune system is still pretty primitive, and we've got to look into that. That's very important data to look at as we move forward.
Eric tweets at AirTalk, I get my second vaccine shot Thursday, but my extended family's gathering with a group of about 20 for Mother's Day on Sunday. Most of them have not been vaccinated. I'm not sure if that short time is enough for me to feel comfortable attending. Should I skip it? Again, Eric, this would be his second vaccine, getting it Thursday, what would that be, 3 days before the Mother's Day gathering.
Yeah, so we know that the vaccine takes about 2 weeks to really kind of set in and gel. So 2 weeks after your second shot with the mRNA vaccines or 2 weeks after your only shot with the one shot of J&J, then you'll be fully immune. So he won't be fully immune when he attends the Mother's Day festival there. So what probably would be a good idea is if he does want to do that, to wear a mask, as should the other unvaccinated people if it's indoors. If it's outside, to maintain social distancing and wear a mask if you have interactions that are closer than that. So you do have to kind of tread a little bit lightly when you haven't been fully vaccinated. 2 weeks after your second shot with the mRNA vaccines and 2 weeks after the first shot with the J&J.
My colleague, KPCC John Raby, just texted me that, like Norma in Lakewood, he got the same message from the state this morning that he was due for his second shot that he never received. And so John wondering if Kaiser's records aren't communicating well with the state. Good question, John. I don't know if Norma's a Kaiser patient or not, or if she got, because I guess you don't have to be a Kaiser patient to have received your vaccination at Kaiser. They offered it to the whole community. But that's a really good point to raise. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Excuse me. Jane asks on the page, is it known yet if 12 to 16-year-olds who were in the vaccine trials had side effects similar to those in the older age groups who received the vaccine?
That data hasn't been completely released yet, but that is coming, and I've not seen any suggestions to the that there were any additional or more concerning reactions. So, yeah, it may be that the younger people do have a robust reaction after the second vaccine that might be a little bit more dramatic with high fever and so forth. They have very young immune systems that are very responsive. But sometimes children, they do have a different way of responding as well. So it's that data has not been released, but it will be important to look at. But I don't think there's been any surprises, shall we say, at this point.
What conversations have you been having with your patients about, with them asking you about getting their kids vaccinated once it's available?
I encourage it. I think that it's very, very important. We know that this virus, although it's not as perhaps as dangerous in younger children, that it can occasionally be very dangerous and can kill young children. And so that would be a devastating thing for any parent to have to live through when you can provide them with some protection. And so it's very important to do it. The data and the studies that are being done are carefully done. They have a fairly large amount of subjects that they're looking at, and I think that it would be very, very important for parents to get their children vaccinated. COVID-19 is a terrible disease. It has long-term side effects in people that even recover or have mild disease. And so it's really something that I think you need to address. It's a very, very serious infectious disease, and we can prevent it.
JR on the AirTalk page asks, how long does immunity from natural infection last, assuming that some people who got COVID this past winter declined the vaccine? Would we expect cases to increase again once their immunity wears off?
Well, the answer is we do know that people can get COVID again who have had it once. Some of that may be driven by variants. But that also probably speaks to the fact that natural infection doesn't give you as robust immunity as the vaccines do. Natural immunity may begin to wane about 6 months after the process. It can be as soon as 3 months, and that's why the CDC has chosen 3 months after your acute infection, recommending people get vaccinated regardless of the fact that they had natural infection. So we do know that it sort of dissipates, and it's very, very important to try to vaccinate those people. They may only need to have one shot. That's a possibility. We're looking at that as well right now. But it is important that they get vaccinated.
Now, multiple KPCC colleagues are reaching out to me, hearing this conversation, saying, yeah, I got the same thing like Norma from the My Turn State website, saying that I missed my second shot when I actually got it. And so, you know, this is just obviously a small group. If this is indicative of something larger, I wonder, Dr. Schreiner, if this means, you know, where we're hearing about 10% of whatever people not getting their second vaccinations, if at least some of this might be attributable to a record-keeping problem.
I think that's a very good point, Larry, and that speaks to the power of programs like yours that really discuss this so that it's out there for people to say, hey, that's happened to me too. I think that's something to look at. There have been some problems with the platforms for collecting data. You know, they switched from prep mode to this My Turn thing and sort of midstream. And so, you know, there's a lot of data problems in terms of that the actual event occurred. People got the shot in their arm, but there's no record of it, and then that triggers a you didn't get your second shot kind of data. So I think that's a very, very good point, and it's something to look into, and perhaps the My Turn people are listening as well, and they can look back on their records and see what's going on.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital with us. Paul in Irvine, good to have you with us. Your question, please.
Yes. My wife has been in Canada visiting family for a while, and she got her first shot there about a month ago. It was the AstraZeneca, and because of shortages there, her second shot isn't scheduled to July, and she wanted to come home before then, but we don't have AstraZeneca here, so I'm wondering if there's a recommendation for what she could do.
A tough situation. We generally like people, for the most part, to keep their second shot with the first shot. In other words, she should get another AstraZeneca vaccine. It can be stretched out a little bit longer than we've originally thought. They've done that in England. The other possibility is for her to go ahead and get probably to switch platforms and to get maybe an mRNA vaccine, but there are no data on that. So I would probably recommend at this point, if she can get that second shot, even if it's delayed, it would probably be a good idea. If not, it is possible maybe to go ahead and use one of the other, to use the J&J, but there are no data on that, and I think with those vaccines, we do want to be a little bit more careful about mixing them up. So I would strongly encourage her to somehow get the second AstraZeneca if possible.
All right, so many good questions here. Let's see, John in downtown Los Angeles said, after getting vaccinated, I took an antibody test that showed no antibodies generated. I have an autoimmune disease. Could that have been the reason the test result came back as it did? John would also like anything you could tell us about the most accurate antibody test to use.
So that is happening. We've been doing a little antibody test ourselves at the hospital, and we have a few people that appear to be non-responders. But again, the immune system is very complicated. And so if they're exposed to the virus, it may well be that their T cells and B cells, that's the cellular part of your immunity, which is probably the more important part, will know what to do and make appropriate neutralizing antibodies. the very best tests that are done to assess somebody's immune response after vaccination are done in laboratories and have been done for the Pfizer and Moderna trials, where they take someone's T cells or B cells as their serum, and they present the virus, and then they watch to see if it creates what we call neutralizing antibodies in that setting. So that's a very expensive, very elaborate test to do. We can't do that routinely for people. So a random sample of antibodies may not be as informative as we perhaps thought. But I do suspect, because of his autoimmune disease, he may be a little bit more likely to have a non-response and should be extra careful. But that doesn't mean that he wouldn't respond if he were exposed to COVID.
Jennifer in Claremont says, I got shingles right after my second Pfizer shot. I know initially the CDC said that would be a coincidental response not caused by the vaccine, but she wonders if there's any new information on whether vaccines could cause a response like that.
Well, we do know that the vaccines, there were Bell's palsy, that's also caused by herpes simplex virus, and we know that stressors can produce reactivation of herpes viruses like herpes zoster and herpes simplex. So that probably is more related to sort of the stress around getting the vaccine and maybe a little bit of stress induced by the vaccine that caused an outbreak of the shingles. But it doesn't necessarily have any sort of virus-to-virus type interaction that we know of. Again, a lot of the stuff isn't known, so we're going to have to study that. That's not an uncommon reaction to happen after any kind of vaccination. We see it in people who get influenza vaccines as well.
Loring writes on the AirTalk page, I had both doses of the Pfizer vaccine, but I experienced flu-like symptoms following the first dose rather than the second. Could this indicate that I may have unknowingly had COVID previously?
It's possible, but it's, you know, generally people have some sort of indication that they've had it. The most common and unique one for this disease is this loss of sense of taste and smell. And so if that happens, that's very suggestive of COVID, although it can occur with other viruses as well, rhinovirus in particular. So, but yes, some people have had responses after or reactions after the first vaccination. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they were exposed to COVID, but it's possible. And I don't know if she was in a venue, or if she's a healthcare worker or someplace where she may have had sort of what we call microvariolation, where they have micro exposures and that may be stimulated her immune system. Hard to know.
Well, there is the asymptomatic infection, right, where people don't get any symptoms that they're aware of.
Exactly. And some of those folks, if you query them, if you really question them, you can sort of tease out some symptoms maybe, sometimes. But there are, as you pointed out, there are many people that really don't even know they're infected, and off they go spreading the virus. So that could be another situation in this case as well.
And that makes sense. I didn't realize that there were a number of these what were thought to be asymptomatic. When you ask more closely, there were subtle indications that maybe the person didn't pick up on. Nylon in Redondo Beach says, we've heard about bats, gorillas, etc. getting COVID-19. If all humans are vaxxed, but animals kept the virus alive, could it then pose a future threat?
Well, zoonotic spillover events like this one are going to be something we're going to have to face. And I think this pandemic that has hit us, and this is a very, very historic event, really has to teach us that we have to take good care of the natural environment. We have to be respectful of animals and how we treat them. We need not to put them in stressful situations where we capture them and put them in tiny little cages where they can spread viruses and other pathogens amongst themselves and then infect humans. We need to be careful about destroying environments that have viruses in them that we've never experienced before. And there's a lot of lessons to be learned from this pandemic, and that's perhaps one of the most important to try to prevent future spillover events. Animals do harbor viruses, and they continue to be reservoirs of virus, and that's part of their evolution. They may not be sick with them, and that's certainly the case with this particular pathogen. So this is a very hard lesson to learn, but we hope that for all the people that have suffered with this disease and have lost loved ones, that science and truth about this disease really is the legacy for those people that we've learned have learned our lesson and are trying to improve our behavior on the planet.
Dr. Schreiner, before I let you go on a totally different subject, because I know you grew up in Pasadena, went to John Muir High School. I assume you've been in the Central Library for Pasadena many times, right?
Yes.
Spectacular 1924 Myron Hunt design building. The Pasadena Star News just reporting that the city of Pasadena has ordered the closure of the Central Library due to seismic safety concerns. Apparently, a recent structural assessment, this according to the Star News, found that the building is composed of unreinforced masonry, bearing walls that support concrete floors and walls. They've been widely recognized, this type of construction, as a hazard to life safety due to the potential collapse during an earthquake. That from Pasadena spokeswoman Lisa Derderian. This is terrible news because I know for buildings like this, where it's found that unreinforced masonry, then it sets off a whole debate about whether you can cost-effectively retrofit the building and save it. And this was the first building constructed in that historic Civic Center for Pasadena that includes the gorgeous Pasadena Auditorium, the City Hall, all those buildings on that access north-south. So, Dr. Schreiner, some bad news today.
Well, I certainly hope that they can come up with a plan to save it because it is a gorgeous building. And I think all of us who've been inside know the smell of the inside of a library. That's a very distinct and very pleasant scent.
So. Yeah, great place. Dr. Schreiner, thanks so much. Have a great rest of your day. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon.
You too, Larry. Thank you so much.
Joining us, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist. Coming up on Air Talk, mindfulness, being in the moment, keeping oneself centered and not succumbing to all the noise and reacting to everything going on around us. We'll talk about how mindfulness has grown in popularity during this time of the pandemic with all the anxiety and stress associated with it. We'll be back in just 90 seconds.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.